Welcome everybody to this LSE Middle East Centre seminar. My name is Michael Mason from the Department of Geography and Environment here at LSE and also the Middle East Centre. Today's seminar, I'm delighted, I've been looking forward to this very much. Today's seminar represents the culmination of one of the academic collaboration projects that we fund through the LSE Middle East Centre. The collaboration projects are funded by the Emirates Foundation. They started in 2011-12. I think this was one of the first five collaboration projects which started for the centre. We have a call, I think, for the next round on the LSE Middle East Centre website, anybody interested. I think we have, how many do we have at the moment in the current year, Bob, Sandra, about four or five of the current?
That's four, okay.
So if you're interested in that, please look at the LSE Middle East Centre website. You'll see publications, reports, and so forth involving the various collaboration projects and also other activities of the Middle East Centre and the events for both this term and I think on into the new year. I'm going to say a little bit about the running order, then I'll introduce the speakers. A few sort of rules of housekeeping. Could you please make sure your phones are silenced, please? We're going to have one of the presenters will talk for 40, 50 minutes, and then her colleagues will be available for questions and discussion, and I'll chair that questions and discussion. The title of the seminar today, and what if one spoke of the land, labour, food, and the making of space in modern southern Lebanon, relates to a project looking at the extent to which sort of food production, food security is an issue in terms of the making of the landscape of southern Lebanon. I'm a geographer by training. I'm always impressed by and fascinated by projects which synthesize different types of knowledge together to understand what's going on in a particular place and the processes which govern what happens in a particular place. And you'll see in this presentation, I'm sure, very much the type of work, impressive, in-depth, collaborative work it takes to really understand the fine texture of what happens in terms of the production, reproduction of particular types of landscapes. In this case, a sort of a rural agrarian landscape, but the same principle can be applied to urban landscapes. Our speakers are distinguished. I'll introduce them briefly. On my left, Professor Martha Mundy is Professor Emeritus of Anthropology at LSE. Martha will be making the presentation. To her left, Professor Rami Zuraik, who's Professor of Ecosystem Management at the American University of Beirut, and Cynthia Garrios, who's a researcher at the American University of Beirut, who were the key team involved in this project. You have a fourth colleague, don't you, who can't make it today, who is?
Well, as usual, UKBA is not very helpful for visas for non-nationals applying. It's the third time it happens to me to be involved in this kind of a saga. So saga was refused on the first round for no obvious reason, but and so then it became very complicated to reapply. So we are very much regret that Sakhar Noor, who is a sociologist and an agronomist by training, can't be with us today, and he was slated to be with us today. But I'll speak to his work here. I'm pulling on everybody's work here, as you will see.
This event has been recorded, I think, for a later podcast. If you want to tweet about this event, the hashtag is hashtag LSE Lebanon. And like I said, we'll have about 40, 50 minutes of the main presentation, then we're open to questions and discussion, and I'll explain about the arrangements for taking questions and discussion at that point. So could I first ask us, please, to welcome our speakers for the seminar today. Welcome, Martha.
And what if one spoke of the land? I'll begin with three observations. Then I'll talk about a development out of that, move on to our research questions. Three observations. Media and academic commentary recognize that across the Arab world, but particularly in the Arab East, there has been over the last 40 years a tremendous decline in food self-sufficiency and a consequent boom in food imports. This is generally tied to very rapid urbanization of the region over the last decades, an urbanization not matched by adequate growth in employment or political participation. And the third observation, a close look at the unfolding of protests across the region since 2011 reveals that these reflect rural distress quite as much as urban discontent. The volumes of commentary on Arab social politics since 2011 have not built on nor stimulated new research on the interface of man and land where food is made. Mutually conditioning, man is here understood as mediated through capital, technology, work and markets, and land apprehended in its diversity, appropriation, spatial and natural ecological plenitude. But for research on the Arab world in general, it is as though with the reduction of the proportion of the population occupied full-time in agriculture, rural space and people have indeed become but the residual of something not yet urban. It is not so just in academic politics. In a country such as Lebanon, the same can be seen in the categories, the very categories of land zoning. Although in some places, such as the plains of the Bekaa Valley, there are some constraints, elsewhere the regulations outside Greater Beirut allow building three stories on any land and throw onto municipalities the option of any further regulation. The result is that effectively any land can be built on and in any way the owner chooses. In today's brave new Middle East, it sounds terribly old-fashioned, a ringard, the French might say, to pose classical agrarian questions, such as, is there a place for family farming units today? Or, in a more modern language, what to do with rural unemployment? So indeed it is common to read in policy documents that the small size of the bulk of agricultural units in Lebanon, 80% of holdings being under 2 hectares, is an unfortunate consequence of subdivision by inheritance and inimical to raising agricultural productivity. Policymakers are consequently not disturbed by the generally increasing size of the very large agricultural exploitations. Nor are they worried about smallholders and their lands, for which they have a solution, pluriactivity, if land and people are to stay in agriculture. Well, let us take a less old-fashioned agrarian question. Is the dominance of capitalist relations in food production, of today's global food regime, leading to destruction of the ecological bases for that very production? If this question, that of a metabolic rift in the jargon, is posed in studies of the region, it tends to be so in relation to the consequences of the region's wars, rather than placing those wars within a wider political economy. In any case, answers to the basic agrarian questions require investment in natural, socio-economic, and historical data to document the changing interface of society and land. And why invest in that when the policymakers already know the answers? We beg to demur. The observations with which we opened confirm that the policymakers do not know the answers. Research into such fundamental questions barely exists for the Arab world. Our research questions. On a small scale, we have sought to reopen the two agrarian questions posed above within the framework of a political ecology, that is, through an analysis of both faces of the interface society-land. Land and society have intertwined histories and bear the marks of the past. That is why we have written of the palimpsest of agrarian change. Past forms and past representations lie below, not entirely erased, but informing those of the present. Our research has focused on one area of South Lebanon, Jebel Amel, Iqlim Shomar, as it was known prior to the creation of a unified Lebanon after World War I. In this zone, as more widely in South Lebanon, there is a contrast between villages where historically a single landlord or two held most of the land, and villages where resident villagers owned most of the land. In our case study, we examined the landlord village farms of Sinai, Safur, Shilbal, and Dmul, and the largely self-owning village of Ansar. For ease of comparison and following contemporary usage, I shall refer to the first as mezere, that is farms, and the latter as balda, or agriborg. It should be noted, however, that in documents from the Ottoman period, the first were not termed mezere, i.e. there was nothing predetermined by the administration to ensure that they would have a different development, the one from the other. The area covered is some 28 square kilometers, that of the four mazara together being roughly comparable to that of Ansar, 77% or just over three quarters of the area of Ansar. This allows us to compare the different patterns in land use between landlord states and village ownership over time. But what will the results of this investigation bring to debates at the wider scale concerning agrarian questions in the Arab world? There, since the 1990s, government policy became increasingly hostile to the pro-small holding agendas of the era of land reform, the 50s to the 70s, and to the principles of agrarian cooperatives and support for farmers who do not structure all their production for the market. Lebanon forms something of an exception in the region, since it never experienced any land reform. If in the 19th century Lebanon was renowned for peasant uprisings, in the 20th century the struggle over access to land was resolved time and again by out-migration of the farming population. How then did production continue even for the landlords? In line with the free market orientation of the country, this was resolved by importation of labor, of the settlement of Palestinians after 1947 near agricultural zones, and of recruitment of Egyptians, Sudanese, and above all Syrians in more recent decades. Thus, there was no rupture in large holdings. Their roots and those of the self-owning villages extend well into the past. But there has been marked transformation in the society that called the land home. We shall argue here that the agrarian questions, that is the ecological and social consequences of present processes of land use on the scale of food producing units, need to be examined in the context of the quality of the society land nexus that emerges, and not only in the narrow abstractions of market revenue. To say this is easy, but to document the palimpsest of agrarian change is a decidedly more difficult enterprise. A quick word about our methods. As you've been introduced to the research team by my colleague Michael, I will be very quick. Cynthia Rarios, landscape and geographical analyses and help with archival work. Sagar Noor, in his absence, ethnographic and oral history research, resident in Sinai and the area under study, and historiographical survey. Myself, archival and historical analysis, bringing the Ottoman documentation to what is known from the Mandate period, and Rami Zurek, landscape, soil, and ecosystem analysis. I am presenting for all of us, but I trust that you will direct your questions primarily to Cynthia and Rami. What we present here are findings that themselves raise further questions. Research such as we have been doing entails ongoing development of methods, integration of new data sources, and revision of methods and questions through analysis of the results. our aerial photographic and cartographic material goes back only to the 1950s. Before then, we rely on life and ethnographic histories, which take us essentially to the 1920s. Before that, only written records remain. In this seminar, I'm combining these sources into a single narrative and skipping over any prickly methodological issues inherent in such combination. Results. What then do we know of the history of settlement, land use, and property relations in the four Mazere and the one Agroburg for the period before we can chart change through cartography, photography, and ground proofing? A word on each. Settlement. Although, as said, the land area of Ansar is comparable to that of the four Mazare combined, the number of residents in Ansar was about three times all those in the farms in the 1860s and four times the same in the 1890s. Clearly, the Agriburg, Ansar, and its sister self-owning village, Duer, which was appeared on that first early map of the area, provided labor and oxen to the Mazere, among which only Sinai appears as a small village, its houses being substantial in value, although limited in number, suggesting the cultivators in Sinai had considerable livestock holdings. The different trajectories of the Mazere to that of Ansar become consolidated during the first half of the 20th century, with only Sinai among the Mazere gaining meaningfully in number of inhabitants. Land use. Land use differed between the farms and the burg. While Ansar had over a tenth of its land with trees, that is olives and figs, that formed a central part of household diets, the Mazare were essentially devoted to field crops, grains, legumes, and tobacco. Even in Sinai, the number of olive trees was small. In Sinai, however, there was a joint development of tree plantation that reached almost 39% of the taxable value in 1893, which the records indicate vanished two decades later. The numerous small plots with trees were registered by two sons of the mashayikh holder, with, it is noted, partners or sharecroppers, presumably village cultivators, as tree planting entails the acquisition of rights, at least to the trees and usually also to land, by the cultivators under Mugharasa contracts. We do not know whether figs or mulberry trees were in question. There is no memory of the latter in Sinai, but that is not necessarily surprising. In Ansar, mulberry plantations, linked to silk production, were developed by larger landholders. Presumably in response to the fall in the price of grain, which reached its lowest point in 1894, before rising by 1908 back to the level of the 1870s. In any case, such extensive tree cultivation did not last in Sinai. By 1911, taxable land in Sinai was declared to the fisc to be all plough land. The development of mulberry plantations in Ansar, with 1,612 mulberry trees registered in 1893, would, as elsewhere in Lebanon, become reversed come World War I. But the domestic food products of figs were at the same date in 1893, there were 2,279 trees, and olives, with 1,975 trees, were to remain central in the village. These were integral to the important holdings by women at the time. In 1893, 42% of the land holdings in Ansar, 42%, were held solely by or jointly with women. Such holdings concerned a total of 18% of the village land. In the Mazare, important though the labor of women may have been, little of anyone's labor translated into ownership. Women appeared there as owners among the commercial capitalists who lent money to the grain entrepreneurs, the mashayikh of Iqlim Shomar among them, from the 1890s. But I've been getting ahead of the slides here. Property. To understand these stark differences in land use, we need to examine the history of property relations. Of course, the area that we're considering is roughly comparable in its ecological and physical properties, so we can actually speak of property relations on their own. The large landholdings in Iklim Shoma are usually traced to the allocation of villages to mashayikh, whom in the later 18th century Ahmed Jazar Pasha had ousted from rule as armed middlemen of the wider region, and in particular from the area south of the Litani River, Bilad Bishara. On the restoration of Ottoman power, the governor Suleiman Pasha, the just in Lebanese written tradition, sought in 1820, by assignment of villages in Iklim Shomar, to settle and satisfy the troublesome mashayikh. The village of Ansar, its mazra'a, mace, and the agriborg of Sarafan down on the coast were the three settlements explicitly excluded from such assignment. This settlement did not remain untroubled. The Egyptian occupation of the area of Greater Syria, which ran from 1831 to 1841, again sought to tax and to conscript the population directly. And with the return of Ottoman power from the 1840s, personal tax assignment was no longer a policy backed from the port. Thus, the gradual transformation of tax assignments into property title cannot have flowed as smoothly as the Arabic histories suggest. The construction of property rights remained a political matter, and challenges were made by the Ottoman authorities who sought to regain control for the treasury, and by cultivators to Ottoman administrators and to the new Nizami courts over the second half of the 19th century. Economically, however, the mashayikh were to prosper as grain entrepreneurs in the years 1840s to the 1870s, and by and large to succeed in registering their rights as property under the tax and tapu regimes. But from the 1870s, the market price of wheat dropped, leading the mashayikh and grain entrepreneurs more generally by the 1890s to mortgage land, the rates of government taxation remaining high, to commercial capital, which often enjoyed consular privileges, based in Sidon. At the same period in Ansar, indebtedness and loan transactions increased, but by and large, land rights did not leave the village. The crisis of World War I, a time of starvation in Mount Lebanon and hunger in the south, did not lead in Ansar, as in the Mazare, to a radical concentration of property by one commercial figure whose family had married other side merchants and had developed wealth through transport and trading in the agricultural sector, that is, their sale, all of them, to Yusuf Bey Ismail Bey Azain. Azain was to become the leading political figure of the south under the early French mandate, supplanting the historical mashayikh leader of Bilad Bishara, Kamil Bey al-Assad, as primary political figure from the Jebel Amun. It was under the French mandate that land became registered in cadastral form and subject to a legal ideology of property far more systematically hostile to common property rights than the Ottoman. The resulting modern landlord power over land objectified and unified cadastrally, but farmed by village cultivators with their own oxen and labor, under the harsh hand of an agent, is what Lebanese historiography describes, and Syrian too, but Lebanese historiography describes as a last feudalism, iqta'i. Such radical consolidation of holdings across a string of villages, and well beyond those we are studying, was to end when, in the late 1930s, overextended by the development of a water project, Zain had to sell. The capital that then bought the Mazara had a different origin to that of Zain, no longer from the agricultural economy or local commerce, but from the Lebanese service sector and increasingly money made abroad, notably in extractive enterprises in Africa. agrarian change. Over the entire period charted, agrarian production was tied to markets. It is not possible to write of a traditional agriculture that at some point in time became modern agriculture. The countryside having long been tied to the outside in this region of ancient coastal and inland cities. Through ethnographic and life histories, Sakura Nur has sought to trace change in farming and food production and consumption. In the charts projected here, we outline something of the findings. Even before the tractor came in, there was change. Movement of labor out to Beirut, introduction of foods to the diet of cultivators, an increase in imported sugar, citrus from the orchards developed on the coastal plain, a growth in animal husbandry, and the introduction of water pumps, first in Ansar, even before the tractorization of dry farming. All such changes had consequences on the numbers of families in agriculture and the place of animal husbandry in family economies. Here, our focus is on land use and property relations, but Sakura's work on ethnographic history has charted shifts in contractual relations in agriculture tied up with these major shifts in the forms and labor of food production. Turning now to the period for which there are aerial photographic and cartographic sources, we have data for the years 1956, 62, 75, 1990, 2005, and 2014, broken down by land classes and settlement. But here we shall simplify the story radically, comparing the data only for 1956 and 2014. By the way, all of the graphic work is that of Cynthia here. A glance at the two maps reveals broad shifts in the agrarian system over the 60 years. A major decrease in rangeland, a slight growth in overall area of farmland with very important shifts in its use, a large growth in constructed areas, and the development of an extractive mining quarrying sector. But to bundle all settlements together in the manner of this slide does obscure the degree to which their paths of change differ and the degree to which the divergent histories of ownership marked that development. Tracking change in land use. Let us begin with what is simplest to chart. The growth of extractivism, that is quarrying, which has expanded some 5% each year since 1990, since after the war, that is, began just in the end of the war years. In Safur, quarrying has become the major activity. Begun during the war years on a small scale, it now occupies 15% of the surface area, but its effects extend far beyond that. Only 10% of the land in Safur is in any form of cultivation today. And in adjoining Shilbal, again, some 5% of the area is occupied by extractive quarry, about the same proportion dedicated to a gated housing development, and only some 10% of the land farmed at all. In both Safur and Shilbal, the earlier settlement was abandoned. Clearly, housing developments are the order of the day for landowners. But in this respect, too, the Mazara and the Agroburg differ, with Sinai sharing aspects of both. In Ansar and Sinai, there was first an extension out of the old village core and along the main roads. This developed in the war years, following contestation. It was a rough contestation, which also happened in a number of other villages in the south, whereby in Ansar, landless families obtained rights to plots in the former Musha, that is an area of common land near the village. And in Sinai, as a result of a long contestation, villagers had to settle for the right to buy plots at a reasonable price from one of the landlords. There remains, as a result, something of a core to the structure of the settlement in Sinai and Ansar, unlike the completely atomized subsequent housing developments elsewhere. As in Shilbal and Mul, the planned housing estates have been developed only after the civil war on good farmland or rangeland. Most of the plots are sold to families originally from elsewhere in the south, but who, having made money, often in the Gulf or Africa, can afford to buy plots and develop their ideal villa. Given the model of villa plotting, the fondness of capital for low-risk real estate development, where the state pays for the installation of the networks of water and electricity, however poor the supply of the same, the absence of zoning restrictions, as I said, it's possible to build anywhere up to three stories, and demographic growth in the section of the Lebanese population targeted, it is inviting for the researcher like the investor to project a continuing linear progression for such construction. Two issues should nevertheless be noted. First is whether such expansion is going to prove sustainable or will not crash someday along with all that it demands in the way of mass car ownership. Second, such developments are not in fact devoid of all food production, as inside the atomized compounds, both fruit and kitchen gardens are tended, often by the resident farming families who also adventitiously crop grain and vegetables in the zones between the villas being gradually constructed. In short, the model involves the emergence of new distinctions, yet in part seeks to reproduce in privatized form the types of cultivation formerly characteristic of the kitchen gardens, hawakir, around the old village floors. That said, even if construction covers less than 7% of the total area today, by carving up the landscape, it has rendered herding ever more difficult on the reduced area of rangeland available today. Indeed, how has agriculture changed since the introduction of mechanization? An overview of the whole area reveals that the proportion given to field crops has been halved, while that in intensive fruit orchards has expanded dramatically, notably from the 1990s. Likewise, there has been a growth in intensive vegetable production, often under greenhouses, and a considerable increase in olive groves. Once again, the different forms of property ownership have led to divergent trajectories between the Mazara and Ansar. In the Mazara, the landowners have generally withdrawn land from agriculture, either for extractive quarrying or for housing estates. In the case of Dumul, however, established Saida capital, which had been successful in the transport service sector, combined with political capital to develop the single largest intensive fruit orchard in the whole of the south, technically and commercially managed, dependent on imported labor over more than 100 hectares as a unified exploitation. Only in Sinai is the picture a bit more mixed. After the abandonment of the project of an ostrich farm for export, which would have been the ultimate in delocalized markets. There too, one of the major landlords has prepared some of the best land for more housing developments, but there are both three fruit orchards of a scale that resembles more that of the orchards in Ansar than that of Dumul, some growth in olive trees where local land acquisition has been allowed, they increased from under 2 hectares to just over 9, and although still without ownership rights, a continuation, even a slight expansion on the area of 1956, in cultivation of field crops by the few families of the village who today remain full-time in farming. By contrast, in Ansar, although land and field crops was halved, but it still represents 66% of the land in our region in field crops, as opposed to 72% in 1956, other forms of farming have grown markedly. Irrigated fruit orchards began to develop during the war years, whereas, as we've seen in the Mazaria, that development started only after the war, with the result that today Ansar has almost three times as much land in fruit trees as the massive landlord orchard development in Damul, but generally on plots of 5 to 10 hectares. Intensive greenhouse vegetable production also grew markedly since 2000. But while both these cropping systems produce for the markets, export in the case of fruit and Lebanese more in the case of vegetables, Ansar alone has seen an almost fivefold increase in olive groves, so that today it has 95% of the olives planted in the area as a whole. There are two questions to be asked here. The first relates to the long-term effect of large property ownership by non-farmers as opposed to ownership by families with a long history in farming. And the second, the social meaning and ecological sustainability of the different types of cropping systems themselves. The data on the first is extremely expressive, and you, the audience, should be drawing your own conclusions. But lest the string of numbers and firing of diagrams has led your attention to wander, let me assure you that food production fares overwhelmingly better with the second form of ownership. The only partial exception to the desolation of food production that seems to result from continuing large-scale commercial ownership, in which land forms a speculative investment in the absence of state zoning to protect agricultural land, is the export-oriented, socially detached, highly capitalized fruit orchard development in Damul. That, however, creates virtually nothing for the society that calls the region home. What Sinai continues to produce, notably wheat for local conversion to bulgur or cracked wheat, exchanged outside the wholesale markets, happens in spite of, and hence on a precarious legal basis in the face of, the power of registered property rights. Turning to the cropping systems, we can easily observe that at the social level, fruit plantations and olive groves differ markedly. Olives, even today, grow slowly. They render the landscape perennial. Animal manure, albeit raw, not composted, is used, tying them back to animal husbandry. Their produce is not exported and often traded directly between circles of family and friends. The crop requires labor, but a high proportion of which is family labor, and that of women underutilized elsewhere today. Olives are frugal in water demands and tolerant of a measure of salinity. Their cultivation is intimately tied up with small-scale ownership. By contrast, fruit orchards require higher capital investment, and their produce is destined always to market, and with larger exploitations, which depend on cheaper imported labor, always to export markets. Markets are not simply the zone of blissful exchange the policymakers promise them to be. Research by our colleague Jed Chaben on the structure of the Lebanese wholesale fresh food markets documents their control by a narrow cartel of traders. Furthermore, the larger exploitations often rely on bulldozering terraces to which new topsoil needs to be brought from elsewhere. By contrast, greenhouse vegetable production, which as you saw grew a lot in Ansar, can actually be of different scales and with different mixtures of technology and subjection to market input. But given its restricted development as a whole in the study area, I'm afraid we're not going to pursue its analysis here. To return to the distribution of cropping systems in the settlements, the agriborg of Ansar has developed a mixture of these strategies, which allow for a social productive density to survive. Sinai attempts, in the face of its historical landlessness, to extract such land rights as would allow for strategies like its larger neighbor. But the other farms are a social no man's land, where capital has gone simply to where it thinks it is best served. Before closing, a word on the differential ecological impact of the major cropping systems, as measured from samples all from Sinai. Our project has looked at three issues: the qualities of soil under different cropping systems, the effects on plant biodiversity of mechanical broad terrace creation, and measures of soil erosion. So I'll speak only very briefly here to the first two, the work on the first two. Soil analysis. Soil nutrient level, soil organic matter content, soil salinity and biodiversity are core indicators of soil and ecosystem integrity. Marx, Lenin, and Kautsky have, in their treatment of the agrarian question, pointed at the soil fertility crisis identified by the German chemist Liebig in the mid-19th century. This crisis had accompanied capitalist transformations in agriculture in their day, as nutrients were mined from the soil with each harvest without a replacement, resulting in an unavoidable system collapse. The advent of synthetic fertilizers has provided some relief to mineral nutrient mining, but has usually contributed to the creation of a problem of salinity associated with poor drainage on irrigated lands. A word on the different measures here, and I'll skip a lot of the detail, but you can ask my colleagues for those who want the measurements. But a brief word just on the different measures on this screen here. Soil organic matter is probably the single most important parameter of the integrity of the soil's ecology. In dry lands, soil organic matter levels are notoriously low, sometimes reaching values below 2%, which is the average for Lebanese soils. We here show the differences between the different cropping systems. Available phosphorus, the second matter measured, is a limiting factor for production in the calcareous soils, that's the white soils that we've seen, of the dry lands. Values below 15 megagram per kilo are considered to be low, requiring additions of fertilizers in organic or mineral forms. Here too, the largest values, as in soil organic matter, are observed for olives and citrus. And indeed, olives have received yearly manure additions for decades. The accumulation of phosphorus, which is largely non-labile, has resulted from these additions. Potassium, third matter measured, is rarely deficient in Lebanese soil, except on marl soils, the white ones, where no additions have been made. Values below 200 megagrams per kilo are considered low, and below 150, very low. Potassium is added in large amounts to citrus trees to improve fruit quality. We can talk about the problems in overdosing, if we have time, in the discussion. The last measure, electrical conductivity, is an indirect measurement of salt accumulation in the soil. Values above 2 ms per centimeter are marginal for citrus, which is a sensitive crop, and could result in yield declines. The salinity in Sinai is not native. It is the result of fertilizer addition and of poor drainage in irrigated lands. In summary, to summarize the results of this that I've in good part skipped over, intensifying production in citrus plantations has led to accumulation of soil nutrients to levels that are marginally excessive. Further additions are unlikely to produce dramatic yield responses unless they are done through foliar application. Soil organic matter has shown a positive accumulation trend, but this is counterbalanced by the progressive salinization of the soil. This must be causing minor yield declines that are probably wrongfully eliciting further fertilizer additions. The areas of field crops show clear signs of systematic long-term nutrient mining, similar to those described by Marx and Liebig. Biodiversity, just a quick word. In our study, we have compared bulldozer terrace land, which is that on the left of these pictures, in a disturbance that occurred a decade or so before sampling, versus undisturbed garig land, salich land, which is used as pasture. You'll remember that such bulldozer terracing is common in the development of the intensive fruit orchards. All of the sampled quadrants in the salich area were vegetated, while two in the were unvegetated in the terraced area, indicating a net loss in plant cover density. The flora of the salich area is composed of 16 species belonging to 8 plant families, while that in the disturbed area is comprised of 14 species belonging to 6 plant families. The two sites share 6 species. This indicated, and I've skipped the detailed breakdown, this indicated that after several years, the plant cover has not returned to its original nature. Thus, the shock to the system has been very significant, to the extent that the ecosystem has not returned to its original form. Some species typical of disturbed areas appear in the floor of the bulldozed site. Some edible and useful native plants represented in the undisturbed site include Origanum syriacum, that most of us know as za'atar, and Rami can explain, Micromeria juliana, which I would need to be informed about. We are witnessing here the replacement of a high-value vegetation in ethnobotanical and ecological terms with a lower quality cover. Let me conclude. There are clear signs of severe mining of the soil fertility in the extensive cereal production system. Whereas historically the rotation was grain, legumes, fallow, or summer crop, today the rotation tends to be reduced to wheat and fallow only. If this continues, the production will decline to the point where it will stop being socioeconomic to farm. The farming value of the land will decline and the lives of people will completely decouple from the land. We already see signs of this, such as a dumping of rubbish, which we spare you the photograph of, a dumping of rubbish on farmland during the ongoing solid waste Zabela crisis. It's quite amazing that in villages you see it as not just in cities. There are clear signs of advancing chemical land degradation in the intensively cultivated export orchards. Carving terraces with heavy machinery associated with intensification for export farming, maybe conserving of water and soil, although this remains to be seen as there's should be tested, as there is little soil left to be conserved, but very destructive in terms of biodiversity, affecting primarily plants with significant ethnobotanical importance and with very long ecological recovery times. Part of food production has been intensified for export, but non-export crops, olives, wheat, and vegetables have also increased, especially where the inhabitants have secure rights to land. These are local food systems, contribute to local food security, and are integrated with animal production. However, cash income in the region comes mostly from elsewhere for most inhabitants. Although food production is still the main use of space, there is a very significant increase, as we've seen, of built areas on farmland and a change in the physical physical layout of construction with the marginalization of the old village cores. This is associated with a reshuffling of population of South Lebanon. Of course, the various invasions also encouraged a certain reshuffling, stratified according to remittance income. Thus, in Sinai today, the major work of emigrants is in the restaurant business in West Africa, i.e. their income comes from male labor in offshore service food production as part of a global food regime. With regard to property relations, the free reign of large-scale speculative investment in real estate has deleterious effects on local food production and is not competitive even in the field of export fruit production, save for its advantages of sheer scale, that is, of technical and market power. Ansar, whose evolution begs to be studied in much greater detail than we've been able to do, produces more food from every type of cropping system. And, as you'll remember, alone among the settlements studied, it is Ansar that historically has owned its own land. The society in the region is as different as that of the land to what it was 60 years ago. We have the data to show how, when, and why these changes took place. The economic and metabolic rift between land and people is deeper than ever. However, the land still feeds its people, as the olive trees are telling us. If the aim of policy were to strengthen that relation, then policy too should change rapidly, radically. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Extraordinarily wide-ranging, but also finely sort of textured presentation. So I'm sure there's lots there that will interest, perhaps provoke interesting questions. We have until 6 o'clock, 35 minutes. What I'm going to do is I'll take questions in twos or threes. When we're going to, I think these microphones are going to come around, so you can get an opportunity to talk to the microphone. Have you got any volunteers to hand around the microphones? You're supposed to have some. Don't worry, if
I
not.
Can. I can.
No.
It's my colleague today. You should hear my colleagues, not me now.
if not, we'll just go from the floor then. When you, I'll select questioners, okay? When you ask a question, could you please just say briefly who you are? Could you please try and phrase your question as briefly as possible to allow as many as possible to ask questions, okay? First questions.
Nasser Qalamoun, my name, an ex-farmer of North Lebanon. The question has two sections. First, about the encroachment of foreign capital, and foreign I mean outside the boundary of villages, that whether remittances or people with money coming from other areas of Lebanon, and here compare with the similar towns that I come from in the north, that coming and not only to expand houses or buy plots of land to build houses, but to take commercial developments which makes these villages or these towns extension of the urban life in Beirut or Tripoli or whatever, so whereby wiping out the good agrarian land or forcing prices, very much. Number two is the law is agrarian land law, which means you cannot separate if you want to build a house from the land. You have a free right. As long as you build, as you alluded to in the beginning, you can build up to three stories without any problem, but anywhere, not as in other municipalities, whereby you say you build here and you live there for whatever reason. So in other words, there is a chaotic urban development, which means nobody cares about what in this case. What's your comment in matters of this?
Thank you. Take at least one more before we ask our team to respond.
Carl Mehdi, formally of their policy. On the dichotomy of the two kinds of land ownership there. I just want to ask about the persistence of this over a period of time, as opposed to anything. I mean, you're bringing it historically into this. How come it has actually persisted in this way without fragmentation of the large holdings, without other changes as well in the small holdings?
Okay, last question for this round.
In terms of land ownership and all these new buildings, etc., how much is it possible in Lebanon to sell land in these kind of villages to people from other parts of Lebanon? I think it's almost impossible. Or is it really impossible to sell pieces of this area to somebody from another area, although there's no rule which says you can't do that? And I remember the Lebanese were debating it. And this in terms of, my question is really about the ethnic sectarian composition of this region. Has it always stayed the same since the 19th century when you started tracing the archives, or has it changed? You find other communities buying land then?
Thank you. Would like to start first?
Yes. Let me start with Madawis. This is, to speak in sectarian parlance in Lebanon, this is all the Shia area.
Ansar had a couple of Christian families
in Ansar. One of them remains in our own family, quite integrated in that. In Lebanon, it's true that there are unsaid rules about not selling, but only in communities that are insecure in their environment. I don't think there would be any problem for anyone buying in that area. I can tell you for sure that in the neighboring village of Khartoum, a large area that is 2 square kilometers, were bought by the former head of municipality of Beirut, Musbah Natour, who turned it into, now this is only relevant because he is part of the group surrounding Hariri and himself, a Beiruti Sunni, and he's just back in the area and does his stuff, and it's pretty strong in there. Not at all.
And Khartoum was historically
owned by the Nahouli family. The landlord. And there are a lot
with a big population.
In the area, there are a lot of. This division, Sunni Shia, this is very recent. As you probably know, post Iraq invasion, it came in strength. I mean, let's be very, very clear about that. In that area there, that's very good. I'm just so that for full disclosure, I'm from Sinai, and my mother is Sunni, and my father is Shia, and they married in 1956. So just to tell you that this whole, and nobody spoke about that, all of that. So that in itself is not. As for Christians, there are a lot of Christian villages. Dmoul was owned by the Francis family.
I mentioned commercial capital, they had consular privileges, a lot of them were Christian. Because also they sold. Actually, they were more into mortgaging than actually running.
Really, in that particular area, Lebanon, you'll find other regions in which what you're describing is true, and there has even been attempt to make this into a law, local law in some areas. So I understand where you're coming from. In that particular area, historically and even currently, this is not, with the examples that I have shown.
When they were talking about this, introducing this law, who was supporting
the Lebanese, we don't like to talk in sectarian terms. We don't like to talk, essentially perhaps because it's a taboo, because it is so prevalent in the areas. But generally, communities that feel insecure, that are afraid of advances of other people, of other communities, it will be more difficult to purchase land. There will be an unsaid rule about selling land to others. Although, I mean, I hesitate to say this community or other community, because this will differ in, from with the environment in which this community exists. This is why. And you can assume this safely for everyone, depending on the extent and the breadth of that particular confessional and sectarian community in that area.
But having said that, I mean, the housing, the people who are buying into the housing estates, first, there is a whole quarter, somehow it fell out of the text, there's a whole quarter in Ansar, which is called Hai Hunin, which is from the seven villages that went to Palestine and whose people could get Lebanese passports. Okay, so that they're, they may be mostly Shia, but that didn't mean that they're, you know, somebody you've always had as your neighbor, so to speak. And, that, and they were already incorporated into Ansar. And those who are buying in the housing estates come from all over the south. Mm-hmm. And this for several reasons. Some of the Israeli wars meant that, you know, their house was destroyed some once upon a time somewhere else, and then they've made money abroad and they start to buy. So it's not creating, I mean, to go beyond this problem of the sectarian, it's not, the housing estates are not just an expansion out of the villages. There's a big reshuffling, both in class terms and in spatial terms, of people from other villages and so forth.
We need, and also for the whole audience, because by virtue of the limited time allocated for the talk, we have not mentioned the relationship between land tenure changes and even farming system changes and the recurrent Israeli wars on Lebanon. I mean, this hasn't been so. I encourage you all to buy our book in order to, you know, about the making of space in northern South Lebanon, which you will see how much 1948 and then subsequent wars and raids on Lebanon, ending with the 2006 war, have formed both farming systems, farming society in the absolute, but also land and landscape and property.
But a small detail is the prices of a plot of land in Sinai, for example, is more expensive if you're from not from the village than if you're from the village. So if you're from the village, you get a small discount. That's what they're doing now.
That's neighborhood. Not significantly. Anyway, but that also, this is like a whole debate about that. Like, I'm from the village, I don't get discounts. So you have to be actually living there. Cameron, I'm going to leave Marta answer your question about how, you know, the estates remained the big estates. She's looked more into that. I'll talk to your question. I didn't really get the questions. I think these are very valid comments, and they go in the same direction as what we're finding. And essentially at the basis of all of that is the commodification of land and of your name. It's kind of, quote-unquote, liberation into, quote-unquote, so it's not liberation, but this is what they mean when they say free market. So when the free market takes over both labor and food and land, due to the absence of zoning, which is, as you probably know, is non-existent in Lebanon. Weirdly enough, coming from the north, you probably know that almost all the lands in Lebanon are under land as agricultural land, but most of the country, whereas most of the country is not under farmland. And then you pose, I think, an urban, an urban planning issue to which I would call on my colleague Mona Khishan, who's like right behind you and who is an urban planner, who happens to also be from South Lebanon herself and who is connected to another project with the, and yet to perhaps, if you want to say some words about this, either here or afterwards. But I mean, what you describe is completely valid across the board, and it doesn't go further than an observation.
It describes the system.
You've just described capitalism, okay? You've just like described capitalism in your comment, and you know, like either I have to give like a huge treat.
abstract treatment or to tell you, yeah, you're right, you know, that's true. We find this in Sinai, we find it in Ansar, we find it everywhere. Whenever the price of the land justifies it, then people cut the land and chop the land in little pieces, work on selling it in little blocks because of, you know, obvious reasons of return. Now, this is of course linked to the state policy that offers subsidized loans for housing but not for farming. Yeah, and yeah, you know, around that. You know, I'm sorry that is the case with the state of Lebanon.
Kamel, yes. Well, we've charted, you know, the sales for the Nazar. And yes, today you don't have a single, there's no Yusuf Zain situation of a single person controlling whole lots of villages. But still, Dumul is two people. Sinai is two, three landholders, major ones. Sinai is there's a, you know, because you have a resident population desperately trying to eat at that structure, well, and turn to be more like Ansar. But the others have done what they, I mean, when you know, it's transferred from one to two people, and they're also holding it as sometimes there's a lot in South Lebanon too, where really big money comes in to sink money, to wash dirty money from Africa too, and sinks it into land. So because you have that historical structure of landlord villages, it hasn't broken down, you know, there's no way to, I mean, it may be broken down between two or three or four owners, but there's still very large holdings. You saw that map of Sinai, where you see these lines going across the, you know, you could pull it back off. Now, there are several owners today in Sinai, but it's not exact, you know, it's still a battle. That's why it was a big battle, even to get the right to housing plots out of these guys in the middle of the civil war. So the Lebanese, I mean, there is, you know, an enormous power in the Lebanese elite that passes things between themselves, basically. I mean, the capital comes up and goes down, but there's a basic understanding about the big boys. So Ansar is an interesting case that personally I'd really like to do more work on, because of that other history that was established from the beginning.
I think that's an observation to watch. Sorry, to watch elsewhere in the region, as there's a lot of change like that. Whether this the historical property relations in the area have a momentum of their own in this way.
It's a very important part for the rollback of agrarian reform in places like Egypt, like Syria, etc. This is an extraordinary case because you can actually, you know, trace it so long and know how it came about. Yeah.
Okay, other questions? Please, first? Yeah?
She raised her hand first. Okay. My name is Lana Khattab. I work for International Alert. It's an international peace building organization, and we also work in London, in Lebanon. Since 2009, and we've been recently conducting research into relations between the state and the citizen in Lebanon, so we have kind of, we're looking into gender, domestic violence issues, public space, and decentralization. This was all very interesting. I think from my perspective, I'm trying to think about what do your findings mean in terms of state-citizen relations. The fact, I mean, you've already mentioned a few things already, like all the markets and you know, changes in who are you catering for, changes in demography, you know, people buying or living in different communities. What does this mean? To what extent is the state, as it is kind of present? Who is the state? Who deals with this? All these questions. I think it would be very interesting to hear your reflections on.
And a second question?
I had a similar question. I was just wondering what your ethnographic findings were in terms of how people in the Mazara and in Ansar thought of what they thought about farming now, how they think about farming, because you mentioned before that people are dumping their garbage in agricultural land, and that there's a greater reliance on remittances from family in Africa. So just if you could comment on how the different forms of governing the land, does it have different people farming differently? I was just wondering.
Okay.
Yeah, very interesting. My name is Samir Ramadani, a retiring sociologist, London Metropolitan University. My question is, how far one can generalize from the villages you studied to more broadly, whether South Lebanon or the rest of Lebanon, and at what sort of level of detail what one could generalize?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay.
You'd have to go first.
I'm not sure what research on the relationship between state and citizen is. I think that's like NGO jargon that I haven't been totally clued up in. So if you want to be like specific in what you mean, really, I mean,
in the types and the nature of engagement between citizens or whoever people are living there and whoever the authorities are.
The level of engagement between it's broad, but also it's okay. I just phrased in a language that I haven't been trained in. So ask me a question that is really
I can answer you one thing rather simply, okay? Which is that one usually expects in developed political systems under capitalism that there's a certain tension in, so to speak, the citizens or in the subjects of the state between a citizen person and the little economic person. And it's the citizen person that would ever encourage the bourgeois to accept zoning, okay? I.e., if we don't have zoning, we have no parks, we have no nice English countryside. We have none of this. So that there, historically, it's both for food production and for that the bourgeois too, at the end of the road, has to be a citizen. So thinking about landscapes like we've been describing implies something about the weakness of the citizen's side as opposed to the economic side in that polity. Okay. That's the way I would answer it in general terms. That this is actually extremely expressive of problems of citizenship. And one should be looking at this kind of thing, because otherwise, there should be a citizen side to the use of land, right? Because everyone suffers when you have no parks in a city like Beirut, for example, okay? No public space, that's the urban city. But here we're showing you the rural, which is generally not talked about. But it presents the same kinds of tensions there. And of course, people, then everyone wants his privatized bit because nothing else is being proposed. There is no collective vision, right? I.e. zoning.
Okay, so that's on citizen and state, really. I mean, there is a state, it can be strong, it can be weak, and I'm a citizen, and I have a lawsuit against my neighbor because he overstepped onto my land, and the state is stepping in, and that's in Sinai. And, so there is a state wherever you want to find it, but it works like all states for those who have the means the political means and the social means to make the state work in one direction or in another. A lot of the issues are resolved often at customary level from within local society, if that also may be useful for you.
The findings.
Okay, it's a little bit like everything else. Okay, there are like special cases. So the gentleman from Akka, Ben Batroun, okay, found, I'm sure, similarities, and I have found similarities with what he was saying, and therefore there is a possibility. I mean, the agrarian question is a general question hasn't been put. However, it has its local characteristics. For example, the Israeli wars have been far more impactful on the south of the country, on that particular place. Migration to the city, some kind of farming systems as well, like the Batrones is not a wheat producing area, although there are some places where, you know, and so there has not been as many capitalistic going back to the middle of the 20th century investments in Mazaria that were aimed at producing wheat for export and for something for European markets at the turn, at least at, you know, during the first half of the 20th century. So there are some differences, but and some issues. For example, what does it mean in terms of landscape change? What does it mean in terms of ecosystem function? Question, what does it mean in terms of local society, are transferable from one place to another within the limits.
I was wondering whether our next piece of research could randomize the selection of villages across Lebanon based on your findings to see, compare and contrast, or come out maybe with a more random, in the sense that as one would select a random sample accurately, scientifically, if that's possible.
Well, we had been interested in the very beginning, in going back to work that Rami and others had done in Ansar. But Ansar is right, sorry, in Irsal.
I worked like 12 years in Irsal. And this project was initially, kind of a comparative study between Irsal, which is, everybody knows about Irsal now. And but back then, when I worked there between the 1992 and the 2005, that nobody knew what Irsal was, and that part of the south, and that would, satisfy a lot of your answer. Mm-hmm. But the moment we started working, the war in Syria started, and then Irsal became famous in the wrong way. Well, I don't want to say infamous, but it became difficult to access. I mean, all the places where I have worked are now, you hear them as locations of battles and battles and that. So, and that is a problem that's very common now. Although I have to say that, I mean, the histories, agrarian histories of Jabal Lubnan and of Jabal Amel are different.
Yes.
And the agrarian histories of Al-Biqa and of Akkar are also different. But there are like four big agrarian histories, and the Sahel perhaps, also one possibility, which would be like five big agrarian histories, because they varied in the type of government,
in the relation,
how you govern property, all the way to the farming systems and to the ecology of the places.
Yeah, sure.
So,
I mean, the one virtue of the way, it worked out is that we have a roughly comparable ecological zone and radically different property regimes.
Yes.
Okay? Which, if we designed it, we couldn't have done so well. Okay?
This is a question that occupies the mind of people who are landscape analysts. Or environmental geographers, does land tenure really impact the way you treat the land and the way the land ends up looking? Mm-hmm. All right. And if you actually review the literature, it's equivocal. You don't really know. I mean, the literature doesn't give you a definite answer on this. I mean, there are some data from Latin America that tells you no, it doesn't. And because you also need to start by stating what you mean by tenure. Is it like one form, or is there a web of tenures? So we set out to actually explore this on a scale that's not micro. I'd really call it a meso scale, with different trajectories in areas that were owned by one or two landowners historically, with the benefit of the ability to actually look. Have a physical look at the place going back 60 years.
Sure.
So you actually can see what has happened over 60 years in in what you know in quantitative evidence based.
Thanks to the labors of Cynthia here, who's not getting any questions.
we had the money question about, I think, was it why continue to farm today? Mm-hmm. Why is it as a livelihood or that source of identity? Why farm?
Well, there is a bit of a heritage, so people still farm because of the heritage. There's this big plot of land, for example, where the right of use is more important than the ownership of the land. So people.
So far,
yeah.
The ostrich farm didn't come into being.
So it's and as Marta said, there's less farmers in general in Sinai. In particular, I know there's, instead of 15, there's only 3 full-time families now. The rest are pretty active. So there's a bit the use. That's why maybe they're planting wheat, because it's labor. It's not labor intensive, so they could do it part-time and part-time have another job. So probably that would be, Sal would have the perfect answer for this, but
mm-hmm. We don't have soccer here.
Yeah.
And we've also
yeah.
been working more a bit.
I can speak about Sinai just because it's like my village, and the soccer has done that. People farm because it makes economic sense for them to farm, anchor it in the basic economy of life. I mean, they throw garbage not everywhere. You won't find rubbish in olive orchards. You won't find it in the orange groves. You won't find it in the semi-intensive vegetable production of cash crops. You will find it, however, in the lands that are kept fallow after a year of wheat, which, as we have seen, like, are the lowest value land in terms of production and fertility. So in fact, that throwing the garbage there, which relieves the pressure that's been created by a huge garbage crisis, is it's not done haphazardly. There is actually, localized. There is a logic behind why is it here and not elsewhere. And that logic is connected to that.
Sami Zubeda, I wonder, Mark, well, thank you very much. I think this is really interesting and fascinating. I wonder whether included in your research was anything about the food system and the patterns of diet and the changing patterns of diet in relation to the kind of transformations that and in particular, how much food now actually comes from local agriculture, to what extent is there the continuation of the food preservation of Muna, for instance, which has been a very important factor, as I understand, of the food system.
Yeah.
So I wondered whether you have anything.
I can answer that very quickly, Sam, because I know we both work on this issue. But Muna is like omnipresent in that region, and it's local, like it's from the local. But the history of the landscape tells you, in fact, answers your question without having to go through a dietary analysis of on a per household basis. The expansion in the olive plantation can only mean one thing, which is that. That area, at least, is still used in order to produce food, olive oil that is consumed locally, and olives that are consumed locally. In every one of those places where there are still people living in a society that is, as Marta said, somewhere in between the rural and somewhere in between the urban, but also to move these with them to Beirut, where people live half the time, and to Abidjan, where people still, receive part of that olive oil and burgol and kishik that is produced locally, and mluchiye and zatar and all that. So the farming, the food system that is in fact local is also a global, but in a different kind of
in a very
specialized global
way.
But
and
a quick answer. There has been, I mean, of course, the global food regime has come in, you open, you find mayonnaise inside, you know, and people eat a lot of chicken, and pizza is part of what the forum does on the side of Lahmbajin and Menaish. So there is this blend, but a very significant part, which is reflected in that fraction of the landscape that is still. Every single wheat crop that is grown here goes for local being regional consumption, Gorgor Kishik, and then, of course, very importantly, Harise, and also the Tibben, what they show, that are used, the hay that is used for animal production. Mm-hmm. But then that animal production itself, its product is sold outside in the broader circle, in the median circle. And we have something to say about this, but we were not able to provide this. Mm.
And Sakar has worked a lot on that.
We're
that's why the caveat about the villas reproducing on a private scale.
Running out of time, one last question at the back.
This may be too complicated of a question to answer in a very short time. But I was just wondering, because you mentioned it a few times about the wars between Lebanon and Israel. I wanted to know if you could briefly just say what the significance was, where it impacted, what it impacted, and along those lines.
I mean, occupation, of course, is a no-brainer. You know, makes people get out of of their land and goes elsewhere, but also creates and fosters an attachment to the land. By the Israeli occupation resulted in a reaction from the people of the south called the resistance, and that is that's been extremely successful twice at least. No need to go into an elogious description of what it has done, but you also need to know that it is a policy of the resistance to anchor people in the land, and this is seen in a number of issues. One of them, for example, the survival south of the Litani of the tobacco farming, which is a state subsidy, but which keeps people anchored and then, you know, in tobacco. Speak Arabic. Tobacco. I mean, there is a big controversy in Lebanon about tobacco and about the tobacco subsidies, and the two different parties. One of them wants to keep tobacco subsidies, and the other wants to remove it. And I leave you to guess which party wants to remove it, which party wants to keep it. But I have to say that they call tobacco mahsul al muqawama. The crop of resistance. So remove that crop, it's undermining that. But just to say the intimate connection between, and as tobacco is actually under a state subsidy, that brings me back to the relationship between state and citizen that the lady here talked about. So, okay, that's like one thing only, because the list goes on in many other areas.
Their findings of remnants of ammunition in some of the soil, for example?
Unexploded ordnance is a chronic problem in South Lebanon, and that was left on purpose in the last 2 days of the 2006 war in order to stop people from, and to hurt people. I mean, the destruction of village centers, to foster the atomization of village and the dislocation of local society is also a tactic that's been used in Palestine as well as in South Lebanon. But we're Muqawma, doesn't really matter. We like this kind of stuff.
No, we don't.
You would need to enforce in for Lebanon. UNIFIL is still chasing up the Israelis to show where exactly all the mines are, which is
it's one of the few things unemployed boys can find work in. It's demining, by the way, too.
Okay, I think we've run out of time there. So thank you very much for those questions. That was all sorts of angles there explored. So thank you very much for those. But above all, please, will you join me in thanking our speakers for that wonderful talk?